today on Against the Grain.
Antifa, over the last 10 years, unmasked an entire new generation of fascists. And, you know, they revealed them to be often men in positions of power. Politicians, teachers, professors, soldiers, police officers, pastors. And I would argue that the work Antifa did over the last 10 years was more significant than any law enforcement investigation or academic study, or they kind of outpaced the work that the mainstream media was doing often. And also, you know, Antifa's research was the hidden hand behind thousands of news stories.
The Trump administration uses anti-fascism as a term of abuse and has branded Antifa domestic terrorists. Yet anti-fascism has a long but often little known history in the U.S. Journalist Christopher Mathias describes the efforts of radicals to unmask and dismantle the far right. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Antifa is a bogeyman of the Trump administration. Not an organization, Antifa is comprised of small, autonomous political formations and activists working to undermine the far right, sometimes on the streets, but mainly by exposing the identities and activities of white supremacist militias and other far-right groups. In To Catch a Fascist, The Fight to Expose the Radical Right, journalist Christopher Mathias tells the story of anti-fascism in this country. Chris, Antifa takes its name from anti-fascists or Antifa in Europe, but anti-fascist organizing is nothing new in the U.S. Can you tell us about Antifa's antecedents, including from within the punk scene in the 1980s and in the 1990s against Nazi skinheads?
I think most Americans first learned the term Antifa in 2017 when, you know, all of a sudden this kind of new generation of Nazis on the street of America who were emboldened by Trump, you know, kept getting punched, and there were a lot of viral videos of Nazis getting punched. That's how a lot of Americans learned about Antifa. But, you know, these kind of anti-fascist groups or formations, this kind of subculture, existed before 2017. So I think, like you mentioned, like the kind of most important antecedent and the kind of the genesis of the modern iteration of Antifa starts in the late 80s and early 90s in the punk scene. So we are talking a lot right now about what's happening in Minneapolis and kind of the uprising against what I would argue is a racist project of mass deportation. But the kind of the modern iteration of Antifa also got its start in Minneapolis. And there was this multiracial like gang of teens, of punks, that were getting really tired of all these Nazi skinheads like kind of encroaching in on the punk scene. And like a little quick background there is that, you know, most Americans associate the term skinhead nowadays with Nazis, but actually back in the 80s, initially skinhead culture was like an anti-racist subculture that began in the UK. It was kind of this place of cultural exchange between like working class whites and mods in the UK and like a lot of Jamaican immigrants. And, you know, skinheads were really into punk and ska and reggae, and it was kind of the genesis of that culture, and it kind of makes its way over to America. So this this little gang called the Baldies in Minneapolis starts to warn Nazis on the street that, you know, you get a pass now, but if we see you tomorrow and you're still a Nazi, you're still in these groups, then we're going to punch you, we're going to kick your ass. And it was effective. But, you know, from there, they started to become more politically sophisticated. They started to read zines, like anti-racist zines from the UK again. And these kind of young punks started to identify as anarchists and socialists and communists. And they started to think in more complex ways about, you know, confronting the far right in their communities. And eventually, they, you know, start developing more sophisticated tactics. They start pressuring venues not to host Nazi bands. They start pressuring record stores not to sell Nazi records. You know, they start to identify their local Nazis and make flyers and put flyers on telephone poles warning the community of these Nazis. And then by the early 90s, they decide to create a new name called Anti-Racist Action. And Anti-Racist Action is a play on the British group Anti-Fascist Action. The reason they chose Anti-Racist Action is because they thought the word fascist would sound too foreign to the American ear, so they went with Anti-Racist Action. By 1994 or so, Anti-Racist Action kind of explodes across America. There's chapters across the country formed by punks who are also trying to kick Nazis out of their local scene. They end up holding a conference in Columbus where they develop what is called points of unity. And these points of unity, I think, are like this really incredible articulation of American militant anti-fascism. And the Antifa groups, you know, that I write about today, they still abide by these points of unity. And basically, you know, some of the basic tenets are, you know, sometimes fascists need to be confronted in the streets violently. Fascists should be given no platform to speak or organize. And that means, like, you know, kicking them out, like disrupting their rallies, maybe trying to get their permits for rallies revoked. You know, the modern iteration of this is, you know, deplatforming them from social media. And then finally, like the third tenet is that like the state and law enforcement can't be trusted in this fight. You know, they basically see cops and, you know, politicians as part of a white supremacist system, you know, a system that will not fight fascists the way fascists need to be fought. So that is really kind of the genesis of modern Antifa. And you know, Anti-Racist Action is very active throughout the 90s into the early aughts, and is really successful and kicks an entire generation, I would argue, of like Nazi groups off the streets of America. Eventually, in about 2002, the first anti-racist group identifies as Antifa, as anti-fascist, and they do that to kind of show solidarity with like comrades overseas, and to kind of, you know, I think, expand their work a little bit, right? So they want to not only be anti-racist, but you know, want to defend queer people and all types of different marginalized people. And then basically there's a little bit of a lull, and then I talked to someone once that says Antifa tends to kind of rise and fall with the fortunes of the far right. So I think the reason everyone learned about Antifa in 2017 was because the fortunes of the far right were very good, and Antifa was rising up to confront them.
Indeed. And yet, of course, interestingly, we also see the continued involvement of people from that era of anti-racist action today. In fact, some of the key members of anti-racist action and the Baldies in Minneapolis have played central roles, including in the union movement against ICE, including organizing the recent shutdown of the city, you know, a general strike of sorts. But of course, as you say, in 2017, there was an upsurge of visible far-right organizing. Can you tell us about that moment, which obviously coincided with the first term, the first election of Donald Trump?
You know, it's been a long 10 years. and I think we maybe forget a little bit the degree to which, you know, in 2015, all of a sudden there was an explosion of new secretive white supremacist groups. And, you know, the way I think I describe it in the book is it's as if there was this whole new generation that was trying to resurrect the Klan's invisible empire for the digital age. So you have a lot of different groups and individuals organizing online and finding each other online. And, you know, they still know that what they are, what they believe in, what their the worldview they're pushing would be vile to the average person. So they often hide their, you know, their propaganda, their posts, their messages. They hide behind pseudonyms and avatars and usernames. But at any rate, you know, there's an explosion of these groups, and it really culminates in 2017 with the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville. When you think about that name, Unite the Right, you know, what part of what they were trying to do was bring together all of these new disparate fascist groups kind of for a common cause. And Charlottesville was also a kind of a celebration. They were very excited that Trump was in office, and they felt responsible that their propaganda had helped him win. They often talked about how they had memed Trump into the White House. And I think it's still kind of underappreciated today, the degree to which Charlottesville, you know, the biggest white supremacist gathering in a generation, was also a Trump rally.
And I want to ask you more about that rally, but I wonder if you could tell us what far-right groups emerged at that time or strengthened at that time that were gathering in this unity rally in Charlottesville. How numerous were they, as much as we can tell?
In Charlottesville, you had a lot of different types of groups. So you had kind of your neo-Confederate groups, like League of the South and Identity Dixie. You had, there were some old Klansmen there, you know. Klansmen by this point is growing a little irrelevant. And then you have your kind of straight up Nazi skinhead groups like the National Socialist Movement, the Traditional Workers' Party, which is kind of in the South and in the Midwest and Ohio. You have your more kind of like suit and tie fascist groups, right? So like Identity Europa and the National Policy Institute. So Identity Europa is kind of this like made up of a lot of college kids and college graduates and kind of like, you know, maybe like more upper class Nazis. And then you have groups like Vanguard America, which is another, I would argue, like more explicit kind of Nazi, neo-Nazi group. And then, you know, there's just a lot of other kind of assorted individuals that might be unaffiliated. You also had a large contingent of people with the Daily Stormer. The Daily Stormer at the time was the largest, I would argue, most vile neo-Nazi website run by a guy named Andrew Anglin. And the Daily Stormer at the time had something called pool parties, where followers of the site would gather and meet. So yeah, it was kind of a broad coalition. And then you had some characters we know well today, like an 19-year-old or 18-year-old Nick Fuentes. You had Enrique Tarrio, the future leader of the Proud Boys, and a lot of other people.
Sure. So then can you remind our listeners of what took place at the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville in, I think it was August 12th, 2017?
I was there as a reporter for HuffPost at the time. The first kind of indication for a lot of the country that something bad was going to happen was actually the night before August 12th, there was a giant torch march where hundreds of Nazis marched on the campus of the University of Virginia carrying tiki torches and attacked a group of anti-racist college students. And then the next day, there is a very large counter-protest organized against the Unite the Right rally. And when the Nazis arrive at the park, and by the way, the ostensible reason that the Nazis are coming to Charlottesville is to protect a statue of Robert E. Lee. I would argue that that was just a pretext. They didn't really care about the statue that much. They wanted to have a show of force and to attack people. And what ends up happening is it basically devolves pretty quickly into like a pitched battles in the streets between both sides, with police just kind of letting them fight for 2 hours or so. Eventually by noon, the governor declares like a state of emergency, and then the rally is canceled and the Nazis are told to leave the park. There are more scattered fights around Charlottesville, including the beating of DeAndre Harris, a black counter-protester in a parking garage, which I happened to witness. And then, of course, most infamously, a neo-Nazi named James Alex Fields from Ohio drove his muscle car into a crowd of counter-protesters, injuring dozens of people and killing a 32-year-old woman named Heather Heyer. And, you know, I think all of this violence obviously goes kind of viral across the country, and I think a lot of people are shocked. But, you know, I think what made Charlottesville also such a significant event was afterwards Trump referring to the Nazis there as very fine people.
How did the aftermath of the Unite the Right rally shape the work of anti-fascists on the streets and online?
Well, I think it was a big radicalizing moment for a lot of people. A lot of people saw what happened in Charlottesville or were in Charlottesville themselves and felt compelled to do anti-fascist work. I think it's also important to note that anti-fascists warned the city of Charlottesville and warned the country and the state of Virginia that the Nazis coming to the city, you know, had murderous intents. And they knew this because there was an anti-fascist spy in the kind of planning server that the Nazis used on Discord to plan the rally. And he shared a lot of the messages and memes he was seeing, including memes about driving cars into protesters, basically begging the city to revoke the permit. But the city didn't listen. I think after Charlottesville, there was a kind of rededication to doing anti-fascist work. And there was a very big effort to identify every Nazi that was in Charlottesville. And slowly you start to see, you know, people identified and get fired and lose their jobs and, you know, kind of be made famous for a bad reason. You know, I mentioned the group Identity Europa earlier. A spy that I write about in my book goes undercover into Identity Europa, stays there for months, and he collects hundreds of thousands of messages that they write to each other on their Discord server, shares them with this kind of network of anti-fascist researchers across the country, who then use that intelligence, you know, kind of these like morsels and clues about these Nazis' real offline identities. And they end up identifying about 100 members of Identity Europa, which eventually destroys the group. The other thing I'll say is, and someone else I read about in the book, is that spy I mentioned that was in the planning server for Charlottesville, all the messages that he ends up collecting, again, hundreds of thousands of messages, end up in this database on a website called Unicorn Riot, which I'm sure a lot of your listeners are aware of. It's a independent media site that does a lot of great work. But those messages end up forming the basis for a massive federal civil lawsuit against the organizers of Charlottesville. And that lawsuit ends up bankrupting multiple of the Nazi groups that are in Charlottesville, and it ends up actually sending a lot of the Nazis kind of into hiding. They disappear after this lawsuit is filed. So the significance of Charlottesville in anti-fascist work is really can't be overstated.
I'm speaking with the journalist Christopher Mathias, author of To Catch a Fascist, The Fight to Expose the Radical Right. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain. So we'll talk much more about the research and infiltration that has been central to the work labeled Antifa. But I wanted to ask you about the dimension of the work of militant street politics. How successful, just looking at, you know, you're talking about 2017 being this kind of high watermark of overt far-right organizing, how successful were anti-fascists across the country in pushing Nazis off the streets in that period?
I would argue very successful. So, you know, like I said, I covered Charlottesville, but then over the next few months, I found myself covering other far-right rallies that a lot of people were worried would become another Charlottesville. And a lot of these rallies, I should mention, were part of a planned speaking tour by Richard Spencer. Richard Spencer was kind of like the neo-Nazi alt-right poster boy at the time, kind of this big spokesperson. You know, he is probably most famous for getting punched in the face the inauguration of Donald Trump in 2017. He was in D.C. and was describing, in an interview with an Australian broadcasting company, he was describing the Pepe the Frog pin on his lapel, you know, Pepe the Frog being kind of the mascot of the alt-right at the time. And someone comes into frame and just punches him. He's a main organizer of Charlottesville. And then after Charlottesville, he decides to do a kind of campus speaking tour. So he goes to Michigan State University in Lansing, Michigan. He goes to Gainesville, Florida. I believe he goes to Auburn in Alabama. I go to the rallies in Michigan State and in Gainesville. And what I see is a kind of massive uprising to kick these Nazis off those campuses. In Michigan State in particular, all the Nazis that arrived to see Richard Spencer speak on campus were largely prevented from doing so, and Richard ended up speaking to a very tiny audience of people. Similarly, like, there was very big confrontations with the Nazis arriving to speak to him in Gainesville, Florida, at the University of Florida. You know, his speech at the university is largely derailed. The students that do show up are against him and kind of derail the whole event. I actually interviewed one of the Nazis that was there to see Richard Spencer, and an hour later, he and his brother and another neo-Nazi ended up opening fire on counter-protesters. Mercifully, no one was hurt, but they were arrested and charged with attempted murder. But basically, everywhere Richard Spencer goes, he is confronted, and his fans are confronted, and sometimes they are punched, and they are driven off the streets. And it ends in 2017. Richard Spencer is like exhausted and goes on a live stream and kind of famously says and tells all his supporters that, like, you know, we're learning that Antifa isn't always only going to fight us online. They're going to attack us. And he concedes. He's like, Antifa is winning. And, you know, he cancels the rest of his campus speaking tour. And, you know, the kind of big far-right rallies that we saw throughout 2017 into 2018 really start to dissipate a bit.
While Antifa is most associated with those sort of street battles and militant tactics face-to-face, much of the work of anti-fascists has been about researching and exposing fascists and white supremacists. And I wonder if you could describe that work, including what you started to talk about after the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville, when anti-fascists set out to try and identify the many hundreds of far-right militants who showed up to that rally.
In the public imagination, everyone thinks of Antifa as kind of these black-clad radicals that are punching Nazis. You know, in fact, the bulk of anti-fascist work, you know, 90% is like intelligence gathering and research and journalism, essentially. It's source investigations where anti-fascists are investigating the people in their communities and around the country who are fascists. You know, like I alluded to earlier, a big component of this work ends up being espionage and people willing to go undercover into Nazi groups. You know, the main character of my book is a anti-fascist who goes by the pseudonym Vincent, and he goes undercover into a Nazi group called Patriot Front, and he spends about 5 or 6 months in the group, essentially doing a lot of method acting to pretend he's a Nazi, and, you know, goes on their hikes, partakes in some of their kind of like vandalism, goes to their meetings, and all the while he's like, you know, occasionally snapping photos, he's listening to what these Nazis are talking about, saying about themselves. But, you know, the most significant thing that comes out of his infiltration, again, is 440 gigabytes worth of messages that Patriot Front members are sending to each other, and photos and videos and other things. Again, those messages end up on Unicorn Riot in this database, where this network of anti-fascist researchers who, you know, the bulk of the anti-fascist work they're doing isn't punching Nazis, but it's researching stuff online. So they pour through these messages looking for little clues to identify these Nazis. And they do remarkable work to do this. You know, one of the anti-fascist researchers I talked to read through, he said, about 50,000 tweets to do a single unmasking, a single identification of a Nazi. There's another little stat that I pulled out of, you know, I made a database, if you will, of anti-fascist doxes, of Nazis that they identified over the last 10 years. I collected about 1,000 and analyzed them, but there were, you know, thousands of these of unmaskings. And I found 6 cases where Nazis were, or fascists were identified because they posted a photo of their dog online. So they, you know, they basically, they would post like a photo of their dog in these private Nazi chats, you know, using other clues. These anti-fascists would find that same dog on a Facebook account or a Twitter account, and then they could kind of collate evidence to identify these Nazis. And, you know, when they do this, when they make this identification, they either publish a blog post or they would do like a Twitter thread, and they would, you know, post photos of the Nazi that they have identified. They also had a running joke, by the way, that if, you know, they included the photos of the dog, they would blur the dog's face out so that the dog wasn't, you know, incriminated.
Protect his anonymity.
Yeah, exactly. What I ended up seeing was that Antifa, over the last 10 years, unmasked an entire new generation of fascists. And, you know, they revealed them to be often men in positions of power. Politicians, teachers, professors, soldiers, police officers, pastors, doctors, therapists, people in positions where they could do real harm to their communities. And I would argue that the work Antifa did over the last 10 years was more significant than any law enforcement investigation or academic study, or they kind of outpaced the work that the mainstream media was doing often. And also, you know, Antifa's research was the hidden hand behind thousands of news stories, including some of my own. And I think really were the basis for like our understanding of what was happening in America.
Well, he was not exposed by his dog, but I wonder if you could tell us the story of one of the people who beat DeAndre Harris, who you mentioned earlier, the African-American man who was whose beating you witnessed during the Unite the Right rally by a bunch of far-right militants. Anti-fascists set about to try and identify who those men were. I think there were 6 of them in total. And one of them eluded identification, a man with a red beard. Can you tell us about how his identity was ultimately found?
Yeah, thanks for asking about that. This identification took a lot of work. Redbeard was a man seen in footage, in videos and photos from Charlottesville, taking part in the beating of DeAndre Harris. Most of the other men involved in that beating were identified and prosecuted, but, you know, Redbeard never was, and he kind of became this like white whale in a anti-fascist circle, someone that everyone was really trying to identify. Initially, a lot of kind of like amateur internet sleuths tried to identify Redbeard, and they ended up misidentifying a lot of people with red beards. But anti-fascists, you know, were careful never to falsely identify someone. They were always looking for Redbeard. You know, the police, meanwhile, also can't find him. Detective on the case in Charlottesville ends up putting out a call for help, but no one can find him. So eventually there's a group that emerges on the 5-year anniversary of Unite the Right in Charlottesville, and they call themselves Ignite the Right. So in 2022, they basically announce that they're starting a project to identify each and every single Nazi that was in Charlottesville to hold them accountable. And their kind of operating slogan is, "We do not forgive, we do not forget." And they kind of exhaust a lot of their typical avenues for investigating. You know, they can't find anything about Redbeard in Nazi chats and so on and so forth. And so they end up using a facial recognition tool. And I think it might sound a little jarring to hear about like leftists using facial recognition, because, you know, I think most leftists would have a lot of problems with facial recognition. You know, it's a kind of the apotheosis of a surveillance state. It's used in all kinds of ways that are invasive. And, you know, the kind of progenitors of that technology are often billionaire fascists like Peter Thiel and so on and so forth. But, you know, the way anti-fascists look at it is that, like, the state, law enforcement, fascists, they're using facial recognition against us, and we can't show up to a gunfight with a knife. So they use the facial recognition. They plug some photos in of Redbeard to this facial recognition tool. Incidentally, I am actually in the photo with Redbeard. I'm in the background. They plug it in, and they get a hit. And the hit is a baby-faced, beardless soldier in 2007. And that soldier is about to shake the hand of George W. Bush. And it turns out that the photo that facial recognition found was a photo of Redbeard before he had a beard at all at Fort Benning in Georgia. It looks like he's about to be sent off to fight in one of President Bush's wars, to like in Iraq or Afghanistan. And Bush is actually at the fort at this time. It's kind of a publicity stunt to announce his troop surge in Iraq. So anti-fascists see this photo. They zoom in on the name tag on the uniform, but the name tag is blurry. The one photo where it might be in focus, it's covered by Bush's arm reaching out to shake his hand. So they try everything. They try, you know, figuring out who the other soldiers are in the photo and see if they can contact them and see if they know who Redbeard is, but they kind of keep hitting dead ends. Eventually they decide, and this is where I ended up playing a bit role, to file a FOIA request, a public records request, to the George W. Bush Library in Texas to get higher resolution photos from Bush's visit that day. We eventually get the photos back. You can zoom in on the name tag, and sure enough, there's a last name, and it's Heilman. Now it's just a matter of figuring out which Heilman it is in America. They pour through military yearbooks, can't find anything. You know, they go through public records databases looking for someone who would be about 19 or 20 in 2017. They're still kind of striking out. Eventually, they kind of search social media up and down. And then one day, they see a Facebook account with a man with a red beard. They go through his photos, and there's photos of him in the military, and it looks like he's been sent overseas somewhere. But the most interesting thing they find is actually a meme he posts. And it's a meme of Bane, the character, the villain from The Dark Knight Rises, the Batman movie. And it's, Bane saying the fire rises, which is kind of this moment in the movie where he's kind of talking about all the destruction and death that's about to commence. And the fire rises is kind of like a slogan you hear on the far right all the time. But what's interesting about the meme isn't so much the meme itself, but where and when it was posted. And Redbeard had tagged his location on August 12th, 2017 in Charlottesville. And that's how anti-fascists learned that Redbeard was Jay Heilman.
I'm speaking with Christopher Mathias about his book, To Catch a Fascist, The Fight to Expose the Radical Right. As a journalist, he's been following anti-fascist organizing for the last decade. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain. So one of the tactics of anti-fascists associated with the term Antifa I've used is to unmask and expose just what you've been describing here. And doxing, of course, is something that those on the far right also have done to the left. That is, try to ruin their lives, to out them in various ways. But I wanted to ask you about the left's and anti-fascist's use of doxing against the threat of people on the far right, people who would bring and do bring violence. How effective has this been as a tactic to expose that somebody is a member of a far-right group?
You know, the argument that my book makes is that it was an incredibly effective tactic for a while. You know, I think one of the more significant stories is Identity Europa, which is, like I described earlier, kind of this suit and tie fascist group that's making real inroads with the Republican Party. You know, its members are running for local offices. They are, you know, turning up to Republican town halls and, you know, trying to push the party further to the right. But, you know, after about 100 of its members are doxxed, it becomes kind of untenable to keep organizing the way they're organizing. You know, a lot of their members end up getting fired or kind of shunned from their families. And I think this is kind of the important part of understanding why Antifa does this as a tactic and why actually throughout history, there's a long proud tradition of unmasking fascists, of ripping the white hood off Klansmen. And that's because what that unmasking does, what it leverages, is kind of the existing societal taboo against being an explicit white supremacist or an explicit racist, an explicit fascist. And it leverages that taboo to create a social cost for being a fascist. It basically says, if you're going to join one of these groups, we're going to find out, we're going to name and shame you. Everyone you know is going to know that you're a part of this group. You're going to lose your job. You're going to lose your girlfriend. You might get kicked out of your apartment. Your family is going to be ashamed of you. And you can see evidence of this at work. After these Nazis are doxxed, their internal chat messages where they are talking about how awful it is and how much they're struggling. So I would argue that this tactic did destroy groups like Identity Europa. It destroyed a lot of the groups that were in Charlottesville. And it makes it a lot harder for these groups to organize. But what ends up happening, though, and it's kind of the animating question of my book, is that, you know, as fascist ideas are getting more mainstream across the nation, as Trump and the GOP and the wider MAGA movement embrace more explicit white supremacist rhetoric and ideas, you know, the animating question that kind of haunts anti-fascist work and anti-fascist doxing is like, what happens when that taboo against explicit white supremacy disappears? And, you know, there begin to be examples of anti-fascist doxes having kind of diminishing returns, you know? One of the stories I tell in the book is a Nazi who's identified as a member of Identity Europa. And even after he's identified, he runs for public office in Enid, Oklahoma, and gets elected to city council. And there are other stories like that. I would argue that, you know, we all, most of us know by now that libs of TikTok, what it is, you know, it's kind of this anti-trans social media influencer named Chaya Raychick. But she was hiding behind a pseudonym for a while and then was exposed by the Washington Post. You know, after she was exposed, she just got more famous. And she's on Fox News. She was appointed to the library system in Oklahoma at schools. And so there's a lot of examples of this. And, you know, I kind of use that trend in the book to kind of tell the story of rising fascism in the U.S.
Right. So the terrain has shifted, which we'll return to. But I wanted to ask you, when you look back over the last decade, how successful was Antifa efforts to destabilize white supremacist groups? You know, you mentioned this person, Vincent, who infiltrated Patriot Front, you know, very incredibly dangerous work, of course, to do. But what kind of effect did that have on those groups? I mean, one can think about the state's efforts against the new left through COINTELPRO of infiltration that created all sorts of suspicion within groups. How effective has it been for anti-fascists to infiltrate far-right groups, kind of putting the unmasking question aside for a moment?
I think infiltration was crucial to anti-fascist work. The Identity Europa example, that was because of a spy that went into Identity Europa. I got to listen to a recording of his kind of entrance interview to get into Identity Europa, and it's a remarkable bit of method acting on his part. And, you know, this new generation of Nazis knew that they had to organize in private. So they went to private spaces online to do that organizing. You know, there's kind of this slogan in anti-fascist work that comes from anti-racist action in the 80s and the 90s. It's actually the title of a great oral history about anti-racist action. But that slogan is, we go where they go. And when Nazis went into these private spaces online and private spaces in, you know, the real world, anti-fascists had to go there. And the only way they could do that was through espionage. I think it's a little underappreciated how many spies there were. I think if you go to Unicorn Riot and go to their Discord leaks database and to their Rocket Chat leaks database, there are millions and millions and millions of messages that this new generation of fascists were sending to each other. And it's kind of just a remarkable archive. But the only reason we have that is because of everyday Americans, everyday people deciding to go undercover into these groups. And all these groups were really destabilized by these efforts. And, you know, there's a good reason that the far right hates Antifa, is because Antifa was doing really effective work.
Christopher Mathias is my guest, author of To Catch a Fascist, The Fight to Expose the Far Right. I wanted to ask you, Chris, about the changed political landscape that you flagged, because, you know, what used to be something that people kept hidden from sight because it would be a disgrace to be revealed to be a white supremacist or a fascist, the train is so different now with Trump in the White House, so different in so many ways. And The Intercept reported a fall in violence from the far right, from far right militias over the past year. I'm curious to know if you know if that's the case, because the state itself doesn't track such violence. But if it is, then do you think that could be because the violence of racist militias is now actually coming from the state, from ICE, and in a sense, rendering some of these groups somewhat redundant?
Yes. One of the most interesting parts of researching this book for me was reading about the first and second Klans. And it's kind of one of the guiding theses of my book is that, you know, when fascists wear masks, they do so in hopes of creating a world where they won't need masks at all. So the first Klan wears hoods and these kind of ghoulish costumes to terrorize black people in an effort to destroy Reconstruction, to destroy all the gains that freed black Americans were gaining and fought for. You know, the first Klan dies for a lot of reasons, but partially it was because Reconstruction was abandoned and you know, they had been kind of successful. You know, they traded the anonymity of the white hood for the anonymity of the lynch mob. It kind of ushered in this new era of mass violence. Similarly, you know, with the second Klan, same story, like they fell apart in large part because of the resistance they were facing, but also because they were, you know, maybe successful. They fought for immigration to be restricted and they won. The 1924 Johnson Reed Act is named after a Klansman. Johnson was a Klan congressman from Washington State. And that, you know, basically restricted immigration to a very specific part of Europe for and would do so for about 50 years. So partially what we're seeing now is a similar dynamic. And it's alarming to consider that it is now agents of the state that are wearing masks. And alarming to think about the world they want to create where they would feel comfortable not wearing masks at all. And so you do see a lot of the anti-fascist effort now is, you know, they're still exposing and unmasking Nazis, but a lot of their effort now is exposing and unmasking ICE agents, including in Minneapolis. And I think it's an important project. I think it's part of creating and maintaining a social cost for being the stormtroopers of what I would argue is an ethnic cleansing project. We talked earlier about how unmasking is dependent on this societal taboo against, you know, explicit white supremacy. And I think part of the task of the left right now and the anti-fascist resistance to what ICE is doing is, you know, maintaining and creating that social cost, is creating, manufacturing that shame. It's letting ICE know that they are the Nazis in this movie and that they will be depicted as the villains in the movies their children watch in a generation. And I think there is ample room for that project to be a success. We are seeing the tide of public opinion turn against ICE. There's record high approval for the slogan "Abolish ICE," which, you know, a few years ago was deemed too radical. So I'm glad you brought that up. I think anti-fascist work in a way has shifted to armed agents of the state, which is an alarming development. And like you said, I don't know if the far right militia activity or violence has decreased or if it's not being monitored. I'm not familiar with those statistics, but I do think you're right to know, to mention that a lot of that violence is just being done by the state now.
And of course, speaking of the state, last September, Trump designated Antifa a domestic terrorist group. And then that was followed by a roundtable about Antifa, where he brought together far-right influencers to, you know, name names and settle scores with people who had called them out. There are those who say, but, you know, there's no federal laws about domestic terrorism. This is a kind of meaningless designation. And of course, Antifa is actually not an organization, but a decentralized network of anti-fascists, so there's nothing to go after. But I wanted to ask you, how serious is this threat from the state?
Yeah, you know, it's one of those things, and I think this is kind of the dynamic with a lot of the far right, is that it's simultaneously farcical and absurd and extremely dangerous. So the domestic terror designation is absurd because there is no federal statute with which to designate domestic groups terrorist groups. And like you mentioned, moreover, Antifa is not even an organization. That said, it's still a really alarming escalation. And what Trump is signaling to the Department of Justice, to the Department of Homeland Security, to law enforcement agencies across the country and to the FBI, is that it's open season on the left and to opponents of Trump's agenda. We know that Trump will label whoever he wants Antifa. One of the stories I tell in the book is in 2020, there was a kind of elderly demonstrator in Buffalo, New York, during the George Floyd uprisings. He peacefully approaches riot cops to talk with them. He poses no threat, and he is knocked over, and you can hear his skull crack on the pavement, and he bleeds, and he has to be rushed to the hospital. Video of this goes really viral. It was kind of indicative of the heavy-handed police response to those uprisings. 20 million people watch this video. I think Trump knows it's a bad look. So he starts calling Martin Gugino, this elderly man who, by the way, has cancer, Antifa, as if that justifies what the police did to him. Martin Gugino, of course, is a Catholic worker activist, kind of part of this radical, nonviolent Catholic tradition of pushing back against state violence. You know, he's not part of any kind of Antifa formation or whatever, but that's not the point, and that's not what MAGA cares about. They will label whoever they want to label Antifa as a method of saying that they are deserving of whatever violence or prosecution that the Trump administration wants to dole out to them. So I think it's really significant and scary. And I think we will likely see some real efforts to go after Antifa. And I think it's also significant when you think about it, is that after Rene Good and Alex Preddy were killed in Minneapolis, what did the Trump administration do? They called them domestic terrorists, basically saying, we get to decide who dies. by calling them a domestic terrorist. That is what the Trump administration wants to do with the Antifa label. It's a pretext for committing violence against any of their opponents.
The Trump administration also has a national security memorandum, NSPM7, which basically brands anyone part of the left or progressive as dangerous. And there's a whole thing about, you know, donating to suspect organizations. But beyond that, there is certainly a large swath of people who are liberal, who really don't understand the history that you've been narrating, really don't understand the work that is termed Antifa.
Yeah, and I will say, you know, especially if maybe you're not too familiar with them, or, you know, you're a little more liberal or centrist, is honestly just to acknowledge that Antifa exists. Most of kind of liberal pundits and Democratic politicians do this thing where they kind of deny that Antifa is even real. They claim that it's just an idea. And I think, and I worry, that when Antifa is targeted, that the Democratic Party, for example, might throw Antifa under the bus. Much in the same way I think that they threw kind of pro-Palestinian protesters under the bus. So I think when it comes to Antifa and Antifa being targeted, the reason Trump and MAGA is targeting Antifa in this way is because they are counting on a lack of solidarity from centrists and liberals, that they're hoping to peel away Antifa first so that they can target other opponents, you know? So I think it's important just to show solidarity with Antifa. But, you know, most importantly, I think for kind of resistance right now is to show up for those more urgently under attack, which is obviously our immigrant neighbors and our trans neighbors, and to kind of support mutual aid on that level. And mutual aid is also, you know, I should mention, is like a big part of kind of anti-fascist work and Antifa work.
Christopher Mathias, thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me. This was great.
I've been speaking with the author of To Catch a Fascist, The Fight to Expose the Radical Right. Christopher Mathias has reported on anti-fascist organizing for the past decade. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening. And please tune in again next time.